you know, single, they're heterosexual parents. He does not recognize that this world, we make our families in lots of different ways. Divorce, step parents, adoption, abortion, all of these ways that we make our families. That is the reproductive future that we're all building together. He cannot stand that. He cannot stand that. Fighting for abortion access, fighting for reproductive justice, all of this ensures that we are able to decide if, when, and how to grow our family. It terrifies him.
In other news about J.D. Vance, the Republican vice presidential nominee has written the foreword to the forthcoming book by Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation, head of Project 2025. Trump's campaign has disavowed any connection to Project 2025, a radical, almost 1,000-page Republican blueprint to overhaul U.S. policy on everything from immigration to reproductive rights to the climate. Can you talk about the MAGA-rights' views on reproductive rights, in particular what you think a Trump-Vance White House would mean for reproductive rights?
I mean, a Trump-Vance White House for reproductive rights and abortion access is terrifying. If you care about abortion, if you care about IVF, if you care about sex, if you like having sex, if you like having sex with whoever you want, if you like sex toys, all of those things could be gone, right? This is the modern day Comstock. Anthony Comstock in the mid-1800s used the mail service to try to ban contraceptions, pornography, sex toys, all of these things, right? Project 2025 is just the updated version of that. And Vance is just the updated version of Anthony Comstock. So anything that you love about your sex life, your family, the freedoms that you get to have to build the families that you care about, that you love, build your life, that is under threat with this Project 2025. And I really hope that people pay attention to that in a way that they didn't necessarily hear us when we said that Roe could and would be overturned. Please listen to us right now that they are very serious about this. This is not a pipe dream. They wrote it down. It is their goal, and they will stop at nothing to achieve it.
Can you talk about how Vance's personal background and professional history cast doubts on his public stance on gender roles and family life? Married to a very high-powered, successful working woman, quit her law firm the week of the Republican convention. On Friday, Vance was asked about his wife in an interview with Megyn Kelly.
Look, I love my wife so much. I love her because she's who she is. Obviously, she's not a white person, and we've been attacked by some white supremacists over that. But I love Usha. She's such a good mom.
Your response, Renee?
I mean, he's a weirdo. It is wild to me that you are married to a woman of color and you can't see her as anything other than not a white person and a mom. But right, but that's who he is. He is such a world view in which that whiteness is the default. That is the thing that we focus on, that women's role in society is to have children. And I think it's terrifying that he can't see us for anything else. That he, as I wrote in the piece, you know, he enjoyed them being a power couple until he needed to achieve the higher echelons of power, and then she had to give up hers. I think he believes that women are there to be subservient to men like him. And it is a really terrifying future in which we don't get to decide what our futures are, particularly that women of color need to serve white men like him.
Renee Bracey Sherman, I want to thank you for being with us. Reproductive justice activist and writer, founder and co-executive director of We Testify. We'll link to your piece in Teen Vogue. J.D. Vance doesn't want all women to be trad wives, just white women. Her forthcoming book is titled Liberating Abortion, Claiming Our History, Sharing Our Stories, and Building the Reproductive Future We Deserve. Next up, we speak with Politico reporter Ian Ward about the seven thinkers and groups that have shaped J.D. Vance's unusual worldview. Back in a minute.
Weak man's playing a risky game. Fools, knowing the pen is to their name. Beat sons, I watch from the sidelines.
Easy to Love by Couch. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. It's War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue our look at Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance with a new piece headlined The Seven Thinkers and Groups That Have Shaped J.D. Vance's Unusual Worldview. It was written by our next guest, Politico reporter Ian Ward, who's joining us from New York. He spent a few months with Vance this year for a profile about his first year in the Senate and his broader vision for the Republican Party in a piece that was headlined, Is There Something More Radical Than MAGA? J.D. Vance is dreaming it. Ian Ward, welcome back to Democracy Now! We had you on during the Republican convention when we were in Milwaukee. Now these comments have surfaced that Vance doesn't disavow from 2021 in an interview where he attacked Kamala Harris, AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Pete Buttigieg, calling them cat ladies, childless cat ladies. Can you talk about where does his views come from? Who are the people who influenced him most?
You know, Vance comes out of a conservative intellectual ecosystem that's very concerned with this question of child rearing, family policy, and in particular, the declining birth rate in the United States. I mean, currently the birth rate is around 1.7 children per family, which is below the replacement rate, what they call the replacement rate. You know, if two people have 1.7 children, the population in theory won't propagate itself. You know, and many of these people on the populist nationalist right see that as an enormous sort of civilizational existential challenge, right? That's not just a technocratic issue. That's an issue of whether society can propagate itself into the future, right? The converse of that is they're looking at ways to raise the birth rate through public policy. One of their primary influences in that respect is Viktor Orban's government in Hungary. Orban's government has adopted a very sweeping set of what they call pro-family policies. These are tax subsidies for families with children, block grants for newly wedded families to buy houses, a whole range of things. And there's actually a fairly robust interchange between conservative intellectuals in America and pro-family advocates in Hungary looking at ways to raise the birth rate.
So why don't you begin, as you profile these seven thinkers, start with, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right, Patrick Deneen?
Yeah, Patrick Deneen, he's a philosopher, a professor of political theory at the University of Notre Dame. He himself is a Catholic. He's become known as sort of the figurehead for a group of thinkers who call themselves post-liberals. You know, they believe, Deneen wrote a book back in 2018 arguing that liberalism, small L liberalism, as a sort of system of political philosophy had actually undermined itself, that the expansion of individual rights and the expansion of you know, a free market economy had undercut the collective bases of American life, you know, family, religion, and sort of any sort of communitarian, communal ethos. In a more recent book published in 2023 called Regime Change, Deneen argued for a kind of what he calls a peaceful revolution to replace the liberal order with a post-liberal order. You know, the difference being a liberal order would, you know, is primarily directed towards the protection of individual rights and liberties. A post-liberal order, which is grounded in a sort of Catholic worldview and Catholic social teaching, though Deneen doesn't say that explicitly, so an important caveat. But the post-liberal order is directed towards, you know, the preservation and proliferation of the kind of conservative values and religious values. Deneen's very close with Vance. Vance actually attended the book launch for this book, Regime Change, back in 2023. And Vance has said explicitly that he's a member of the post-liberal right and that he views his role in Congress as anti-regime. So he's closely tied in with this world that Deneen represents.
And Vance himself converted to Catholicism in 2019. His wife is Hindu. Who's Brad Wilcox, the University of Virginia professor who wrote Get Married, Why Americans Must Defy the Elites, Forge Strong Families, and Save Civilization?
Yeah, he called himself a pro-family intellectual, again, a conservative religious guy. You know, the broader intellectual context here is this is a group of people who are questioning whether what liberals call progress is actually good for society, and also whether the past sort of 60 years of social change dating back to the 1960s has actually been a good thing. You know, Vance doesn't think it has been. You know, he thinks he comes from this world that thinks sort of the sexual revolution was a mistake or has had terrible unintended consequences, that the women's entrance into the workforce has not been the sort of boon for feminism that liberals make it out to be. You know, he had this tweet, and he used this line in a couple speeches, that's like, if your worldview tells you that's bad for women to become mothers, but liberating for them to work 90 weeks in a cubicle at the New York Times or Goldman Sachs, you've been had. You know, this is part of his broader critique that the culture war is class war, that liberals have weaponized social views to consolidate and advance their own economic interests. So the idea that it's liberating for, this is his conception, the idea that it's liberating for women to enter the workforce ultimately redounds to the benefit of companies who can benefit from more and cheaper labor, as opposed to benefiting the women who find some sort of fulfillment or liberation in the work.
Let's talk again about Peter Thiel. I mean, when you talk about the great influences in Vance's life, his former venture capital boss, primary funder of his 2022 Senate campaign, gave something like $10 million, where his philosophy fits in here.
Yeah, Thiel, if I'm being honest, Thiel is not spoken. I mean, Thiel's wrapped up in this idea that the society can't propagate itself if the birth rate is low. But Thiel's influence on Vance is primarily thinking about, one, the relationship between democracy and freedom, and second, thinking about the role that technology plays in society. You know, Thiel is a sort of techno-libertarian, which occasionally verges into kind of techno-authoritarianism, but who thinks that, you know, technology holds the potential to be completely revolutionary, but has been perverted by various economic incentives and the poor leadership of liberal elites, right, to become a thing that shackles us and prevents us from building a better society, as opposed to liberating us and building a better society. You know, his famous slogan is that we wanted flying cars when we got 140 characters, you know, meaning we thought technology could change the world, and instead we turned it into things like Twitter and Instagram, which make us anxious, unhappy, and, you know, more open to economic exploitation by companies than ever before. He's also said he doesn't think that freedom and democracy are compatible anymore. You know, Vance has not endorsed that view specifically, but that's sort of Thiel's political philosophy in one line.
And talk about Curtis Yarvin.
Yeah. Yarvin, I should begin this with a caveat, which is many of the thinkers I mentioned in the piece, Vance is actually in regular contact with. You know, he talks to people like Patrick Deneen. He talks to Peter Thiel. He's called Yarvin a friend. I assume they talk, but I think Yarvin is a bit more distanced from some of these thinkers, from Vance and some of these other thinkers. But Yarvin is a blogger. He's a former computer programmer. He came to internet fame in the like early aughts, blogging under the pseudonym Mencius Moldbug. And he articulated this worldview that he calls neo-reactionary. You know, NRX is often how it's abbreviated. He's sort of often cited as the house philosopher of the new right, which is the world that Vance comes out of intellectually. Yeah, he's a monarchist, straight up. I mean, that's how he would describe himself. You know, he thinks that American democracy has sort of denigrated into a corrupt oligarchy, and that the way to resolve this oligarchic tendency is to install a dictator, is a term, that's the term he's used, a kind of national CEO who would run the country like the CEO of a startup would run a startup. You know, Vance has not endorsed in public this whole project. He has cited Yarvin's work in connection with his belief that second Trump administrations should fire a significant number of civil servants and replace those people with people who are ideologically aligned with himself and with Trump. But Yeah, this is another guy that Vance is clearly breeding and engaging
what,
with.
What so. About Rene Girard?
Yeah, Rene Girard is a French-born philosopher, literary critic. He was, in fact, one of Thiel's mentors at Stanford University when Thiel was a student there. So Girard was introduced to Vance by Thiel. Girard's ideas are incredibly complicated, so I won't do them the indignity of trying to summarize them very shortly. But, you know, one idea that Vance has cited in connection with his own conversion to Catholicism is what Girard calls the scapegoat mechanism, which is the idea that in societies, people compete over a limited set of goods, and they often want the same things, which creates social conflict, which is ultimately resolved by identifying a member of that community who somehow wronged the community. You then scapegoat them, often by killing them, and then that leads to sort of social equilibrium. This changed, Girard thinks, with the advent of Christianity, because for the first time, a society scapegoated someone who was very clearly not guilty of any crime against the community. You know, this was Jesus Christ. And so by killing someone who was obviously innocent, you know, the Christian narrative shows that the problem is not with the scapegoat, the problem is with ourselves, you know, and this leads to the whole Christian theology. Vance has said he's like identified with the story and found it profound and helped him, you know, identify some of his own spiritual hangups. So he cited that narrative in particular as a way of explaining his own conversion to Catholicism.
And talking about conversion to Catholicism, Sohrab Ahmari, we just have a minute.
Yeah. Yeah, Ahmari is the co-editor of a magazine called Compact, which began as a kind of union between the populist right and the populist left. He's an advocate of pro-worker conservatism, what he calls pro-worker conservatism, which again, Sohrab is a Catholic convert. This is a kind of idea of the conservative right inflected by Catholic social teaching and the doctrines of the Catholic Church.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. People can read your articles. You talk about the Claremont Institute and other influences on J.D. Vance, who you profiled. Ian Ward is a Politico reporter. The new piece, The Seven Thinkers and Groups That Have Shaped J.D. Vance's Unusual Worldview. And his recent piece, Is There Something More Radical Than MAGA? J.D. Vance is Dreaming It. Next up, Israel vows to retaliate against Hezbollah after blaming it for a rocket attack Sunday in the occupied Golan Heights that killed 12 Druze children at a soccer field, stoking fear of a wider regional war. Back in 20 seconds.
Come and build my garden. It's built with love and daffodil. Come and build my garden. It's half a mile up the hill.
Build My Garden by Grass Future Society. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the Middle East, where Israel's vowed to retaliate against Hezbollah after blaming the Lebanese group for a rocket attack Saturday in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights that killed 12 Druze children at a soccer field. Hezbollah has denied responsibility. The attack took place in the village of Majd al-Shams, home to members of the Druze community, an Arab-speaking minority group. Israel claimed the victims were Israeli citizens, though many Druze in the area don't have Israeli citizenship, are in fact Syrian citizens. This is a resident of Majd al-Shams.
We are not more precious than children who are killed anywhere else in the country, or than innocent killed in southern Lebanon, or innocent killed in Gaza. Our children are not more precious than them. We are human beings. We live our lives in peace and tranquility. Our wish is that every mother who lost her dearest yesterday was supposed to be able to celebrate their birthday, just like Sarah Netanyahu, who celebrated with her son. We need to strive now to sign a deal and stop this damn war. We want to live. We don't want to die.
The deadly attack has further stoked fears of a wider regional war. On Sunday, Israel's Security Cabinet authorized Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant to decide on the manner and timing of the military response. Earlier today, Israeli drone attacks reportedly killed two people in southern Lebanon. This is Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
We're in conversations with the government of Israel. And again, I emphasize its right to defend its citizens and our determination to make sure that they're able to do that. But we also don't want to see the conflict escalate. We don't want to see it spread.
While Lebanon is calling for an international probe into the attack, Iran warned Israel against using the attack in Majd al-Shams as a pretext for, quote, any new adventure towards Lebanon, unquote. For more, we go to Boston, where we're joined by Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at American University of Beirut, also non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington. Rami, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about the significance of this attack, where it took place, and who died?
The significance of it is that it hit a Druze village in the occupied, the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights, which has not been an arena for battle between Lebanese parties, Palestinians, and Israelis. The Druze have kind of stayed out of the Arab-Israeli conflict. The Lebanese Druze are supporting the Palestinians. The Druze in occupied Golan are pretty much on their own, and the Druze who were in Israel from 1948 have become Israeli citizens and serve in the police. So this is a bit unusual, and to have 12 youth playing soccer killed all at once is dramatic for anybody in the world. So the facts of the attack are a little bit more dramatic. But not really much more dramatic than anything that's happened in Gaza over the last 8 or 9 months, where dozens of young kids are killed and babies are beheaded. So there's a problem here that we've had really since the beginning of the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is the imbalance in looking at the suffering of Jews, suffering of or Israelis, the suffering of Palestinians and Arabs. And you see it in this situation. The tragedy of young people dying is a universal tragedy. There's no difference between them, as the person just said you quoted. But we still have a problem here with the political and military confrontation. Israel wants to assert its military strength, that it has a power, it will use it. The Americans, as Blinken just said, he stressed Israel's right to self-defense. He didn't stress anybody else's right to self-defense. So this is a really deep structural conflict that's been going on for over half a century, and it will continue going on with incidents like this intermittently flaring up. But these kinds of deaths happen almost on a daily basis in Lebanon when Israel attacks. Lebanon kills kids, and certainly in Gaza. So it's a challenge for everybody, including the news media, to really cover it accurately. And many in the media are not saying that the Golan is a Syrian territory occupied by Israel, allegedly annexed by Israel. Some of them are now. So there's a series of different dimensions to this situation that are kind of fascinating. And the last one is that the Israelis, the prime minister, the defense minister, with their usual bravado and macho threat, saying, we're going to hit them hard, they're going to learn a lesson they'll never forget, etc. This is a standard operating procedure for an Israeli Zionist government that essentially relies on military strength more than political engagement or trying to dispense justice to all sides. And militarism isn't a solution. Militarism is part of the problem. And the Israelis will not make a big attack on Lebanon because they're worried that Hezbollah can hurt them really, really badly given its technological prowess and its determination, which is far greater than anything Israel has ever experienced.
Now, Axios reports Hezbollah officials have told the UN the deaths were caused by an Israeli anti-rocket interceptor projectile. And, of course, Lebanon is calling for a full investigation. Aren't there also a Lebanon-Israel peace deal that's been negotiated? And you've got these negotiations, Israel-Palestine negotiations, going on in Rome. How will this affect them? And do you think this could lead to a wider regional war?
I still don't think that a wider regional war will come. And in fact, we haven't had a wider regional war probably since, I don't know, 1973, and that wasn't the whole region. So, no, a wider regional war is not in the cards because it'll only lead to wider regional mass suffering, mostly by civilians, infrastructural destruction, panic fleeing. Already you've had tens of thousands of Israelis leaving Israel and more are trying to get out. Same in Lebanon and other places. So, no, a regional war is not in the cards. It could happen accidentally, and this is one of the scary things here. This might have been an accident. Nobody in their right mind would deliberately attack children playing soccer. Well, the Israelis do that in Gaza all the time, but the Israelis are not in their right mind when it comes to dealing with Palestinians. They're fanatics. Most normal people would not attack children playing soccer. So it seems that this was probably an accident, whether it came from an Israeli shell or a Lebanese shell. And who in Lebanon? There's five or six groups in Lebanon that have artillery that they can, rockets that they can use. We'll find out. But the danger is always there that an accident could spark a bigger confrontation. But what you noticed is the most dynamic sector in the last 2 days has been American and other diplomats in overdrive trying to calm things down, which has been a tradition of American diplomacy, but also one of its greatest failures, because all they do is they go around telling people, calm down, take it easy, the proportional response, or don't let this expand. But at the same time, they keep feeding Israel with all of the military means it needs to keep the situation tense and including constant military exchange, especially with Hezbollah and Israel. So really what this reminds us that the whole context of Palestinian-Israeli, Arab-Israeli, Hezbollah-Israeli, Iran-Israeli, whatever you want to look at, has not worked very well. There has been no serious diplomacy that tries to address the underlying causes and resolve them. And they're all resolvable. These are human, man-made, woman-made issues that can be resolved by human beings. But the United States is not able to mediate impartially, except on a few technical issues here and there, like the oil leases and things like that. But on issues that are dear to Zionism, which is, you know, to assert its authority in the region, the U.S. is fully on the Israeli side. And this is one of the problems that we have.
Well, Rami Kouri, I want to thank you for being with us. There's clearly much more to talk about it, and we will over the coming days. Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at American University of Beirut, also non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of development to lead our fundraising team. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of CanadaLand, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.